Hey, what's up? This is your girl, Taylor Wilde. Welcome back to Wild On Season 6, the podcast where you get the insider's view of the weird, wild world of wrestling, witchcraft, and women on Wednesdays. Today's guest is spooky. That's right. Today, we are getting wild, but in a very, very different way. We are going head-to-head with a paranormal investigator. That's right. She's never stepped inside the squared circle. She's never adorned sparkly tights and walked through smoke machines. However, she has battled with some of your worst nightmares. And today, she's going to pull back the curtain on what it's like to be a real-life paranormal investigator. Ladies and gentlemen, my... Okay, thank you so much for doing my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so this podcast is typically about wrestling, witchcraft, and I've been focusing more and more on extremely interesting women. So my listeners might not know who you are. Would you mind please introducing yourself and giving us a little bit of background about what you do?
Sure. I'm Becky Ann Galantine. I'm a paranormal investigator. I started as an embalmer. I was working as an embalmer during the COVID pandemic. And on my days off, I started going to haunted locations. When I started posting about them, people said, I know these stories, but you're telling them in a different way. And it just kind of consumed my entire life. Now people send me haunted stuff, cursed objects, and I travel the country. I've been all over, you know, coast to coast in the United States looking for ghosts.
Okay. Amazing. What made you choose being an embalmer?
I had a friend pass away. I was kind of living chaotically, doing odd jobs. So I was selling vintage clothes, doing photography, and I had all these things going for me. And when my friend passed, I wanted to know more about what happened to her and just kind of go into something that felt like it had a grounded direction.
Sure.
So I pursued that. It made sense to me for the time. I learned a lot about grief and the afterlife. Yeah. And that's when things started to like poke out from the other side where it's like, oh, we're being taught that death is an irreversible cessation of life. But also my instructor thinks that he saw a ghost once, or my coworker had seen a ghost before. So it just kind of blended this lifelong interest that I had. But it all started with a passing of a really close friend.
Okay. So I was going to say, now, did you have an interest in the occult or in the paranormal growing up?
I grew up in an antique store, so I didn't stand a chance. I was always going to be weird. My parents had dead people stuff for sale downstairs, and we lived upstairs.
Okay.
So there was no option to not be interested in the stuff.
Sure.
There were definitely some houses that we would go to where the person had just passed away, and we're rooting through their things, deciding what value they have.
Right.
And like, of course people are going to be like, what are you doing with my stuff? So there's specifically one where my mom felt like people were watching her. So I had always had an interest in that. I grew up in a town where we were kind of haunted by a mine disaster that happened 100 years prior. So, you know, people would say, oh, there was that mine disaster. And there's all these mining houses that still have the rainbow siding from the 80s. They never really recovered from that like oppression of the past. So it's there, like you're immersed in it. Yeah. And it always interested in me. It always interested me. I was pursuing a biology degree at one point in my life. I thought I was going to be a veterinarian, and I was doing like clinical science, and I went to a cemetery and I saw something I couldn't explain. And I was like, nothing I'm being fed in school makes sense anymore.
Yeah.
This isn't adding up. I saw something I can't explain. It, you know, I tried to debunk it. I still try to debunk it. I'm open to debunking it, but it was like, you know, not everything is black and white in the way it appears on paper. So I guess the interest has always been there. I've been collecting talking boards. Most people say Ouija board, but it's actually a brand of talking boards for over a decade now.
Wow. See, I think that's what drew me to you. Now, I found you on TikTok, and I've always had a lifelong affinity with the paranormal, with the occult, and all the things that go boom in the night. And I'm in my 10th year of being a firefighter. and I work with a lot of death and a lot of people potentially having the worst experience of their lives. And I kind of wonder sometimes now, it's like, are we chosen for these fields? Is it because we have these morbid curiosities? Because I always believed that it's not everything you see is real, or, you know, you can't take things for at face value per se. But I do know, having had so many experiences with people basically kind of leaving this world while I'm touching them, you literally feel the energy leave the room, and it's got to go somewhere. It's almost like you can feel it. Like, you can feel it in every ounce of your being. And then when you work with the deceased, you know, that's a part of my job too. Sometimes it's just a matter of someone hasn't seen their neighbor in a week, or a smell precedes them. And, you know, that's a different experience, because there's literally nothing there. It's just a meat suit, for lack of a better term. How do you believe that your paranormal investigation kind of tuned into working with the, like, physical being of somebody who's deceased? Or do you think they were kind of hand in hand?
At first, it didn't make sense, because I'm being told, again, that death is an irreversible cessation of life. What else is there? Yeah. The person dies, and we don't want to complicate grief, so we have to say they're gone now, right? And right. We can't bring in mediums. We can't have tarot readers. We have to acknowledge this very Western view of death, especially here in the U.S. The United States is the most death-denying culture in the world. So for me, at first, it didn't make sense, and I'm like, I'm interested in this, but it goes highly against my field. They're very conservative. And right. You can't just be a mortician ghost hunter, because there's societies and associations, and they will shun you for that. But I found a beautiful little thread that came in between all of it. There's this fine balance between life and the afterlife. And it's more than just, you know, the breaking down of cells, the end of the neurological process. Death isn't just alive or not alive. You have like 30 different things that go through and happen as you're dying, right? You go through the agonal fever right before you die, the post-mortem calorosity, the body heats up, and then ultimately we lead to decomposition. The cells finally are the last thing to go, you know, the organs shut down, and then the cells are no longer being fed and they self-destruct. And then it's like, but what about the transition to spirit? Where does the soul go?
Right.
So I actually put together a lecture called Grief and Ghost Hunting, and I talk about this. And I understand that the body is not equivalent with the spirit, which is what I think you're getting at. But yeah. We have so many stories born out of the way that we grieve. The white lady waiting for her husband, the gray lady who's always looking for her lost child, the blue lady. There are all these stories that are, you know, done with grief. And so many hauntings start with the desecration of a corpse.
Sure.
And while I'm working in the heat of COVID-19. So I'm talking, we had to convert a garage for more body storage, because we did not have enough room for the bodies. I was in shock my first day. I went to the hotel room after my interview. I started in like May 2020.
Wow.
And I cried. I said, this is going to be the hardest year of my life. And I stayed for more than a year somehow, but I knew it was going to be challenging. But during that time, I thought, these people, bodies are getting switched, not in my funeral home, but other funeral homes. They're dressing them in the wrong clothes, wrong bodies getting cremated. Horrible things are happening because we can't keep up with the death. And I'm like, okay, so if historically we know a body's desecrated, it's led to the haunting. What is this entire wave of people who passed away during COVID, whose deaths were denied, whose deaths were written off as numbers? You worked in the field that you do, so you know what it was like. And to have people say it wasn't happening, it was like, I cannot express enough what I was witnessing. Yeah. And it was real to me. And it went from, there was one day I did 8 transfers by myself. 8 transfers, that is 8 whole human people who have passed away. And I will never work that hard again under any circumstance. I would be happy to if it came up, but it's just, that's where the thoughts started reeling. And it's like, what happens when someone becomes a number?
Yeah.
What happens when nobody's there to say, I'm ready to let you go? Yeah. They don't know where to go. And I think where a lot of these ghost stories historically were born The other contrast that I wanted to mention is in the Victorian period, you know, right behind me, I have Victorian hair wreaths, and we would keep mementos of the deceased. We have locks of hair, we have, you know, little memorial cards, things that we save, their photos, postmortem photographs. We're like, we're ready to let you go, but we want you to stay here. We acknowledge you beyond your death. And now we contract a stranger who's wearing full PPE, so protective body gear, when you could kiss someone's hand as they're passing away. And now they're a biohazard to this person. They take them, they tag them, and they cremate them. They go out of the hospital or nursing home facility by the dumpster and are treated like a waste. And I don't think that's acceptable. And I think that that's why we are where we are. We used to have home funerals for a week at a time.
Yeah.
That's where I found the blend. I'm like, we're not grieving the same. We're not acknowledging people the same. And what does that lead to? We say, get it out of my house as soon as possible.
Yeah.
You need to call the funeral home, get the estate done, get the paperwork done. It's become such an expense. And we can't acknowledge the afterlife, especially as funeral professionals, because it complicates grief and it opens us up to litigation.
And where do you think this switch happened? It must have been before COVID, because people have been talking about the high costs of funerals and everyone fears the dead, at least physically speaking, like just as you said it, as soon as someone dies, they call 911 right away and then the mortician. And then, you know, my grandma, who's 96, she told me when her mother passed away, who was very young at 35 from tuberculosis, they kept her in the house for a week. Where do you think this switch happened? And do you believe it was a belief system, or do you think just legalities got in the way?
We had the spiritualist movement, and we had a little bit of a revival. You know, we had like eras in the early 1900s where it was fashionable to call to the deceased. And then in 1963, especially here in America, the Catholic Church finally says, we're going to allow cremations to not be sinful, and we're going to allow cremated remains in the church for a service. Before, we couldn't. So there was a large population of people who felt that cremation was a sin. So now people can be cremated and put into a cheap black box, a standard black box, instead of an urn. And it's all about that cost.
Right.
Same year, 1963, we have the most lavish funeral probably ever, which is JFK's funeral. So he was assassinated in 1963. However, someone named Jessica Midford published The American Way of Death. Essentially, the book says the funeral industry is greedy. They're just trying to sell you caskets, and it shouldn't be this way. So you have this conflict going on, and then the Catholic Church has, you know, opened up the remains to be cremated in the church. So I think that started to get people thinking about what they wanted. And there's obviously this draw away from liturgical funerals and more about the celebration of life. However, at the expense, a celebration of life often becomes something we'll get to eventually, it gets put off. And right. Then there's no memorial service. There's no gravity. There's no seeing the body. Seeing remains is uncomfortable for people now when it didn't used to be. One thing that I think happened is we started watching movies like The Exorcist. We had the Satanic Panic. We are told something can and will go wrong if people linger for too long. We don't want deceased people hanging out any longer. We don't want to welcome spirits. They're scary, right? And I don't believe that. I don't subscribe to those ideologies. I do investigations. I've definitely been uncomfortable. I've definitely had intense investigations, but I don't think that we're doing ourselves a service by, you know, in our mind. But that's what people recall. They recall images of possessions and people coming back not as themselves. And so you have everything that happened in 1963 and then the Satanic Panic.
Okay, you just light bulb went off. So I just did an episode of the Other World podcast because I've been unfortunate enough to have some real physical experiences with the paranormal. And I had an experience, and it's been twice, where one could believe that I had sleep paralysis, where I felt something literally, it started with a noise that got louder and louder and louder, came from the outside, entered the room, and then it was as if someone had grabbed a rolling pin from my feet and pushed it all the way up my body to my shoulders. when it comes to that type of energy that has obviously been strengthened over time, do you believe this is something that has been alive? Do you believe this is more of a sinister energy of just something that's lingering? Like, just kind of, I just wondered what the first things that come to mind when you hear scenarios like that.
I think we have to deconstruct what we think as malevolent. My first sleep paralysis experience, where I did see a visual person open the room, like open the door of the bedroom, and I saw the whites of their eyes, and there was a foul odor, and it was completely black except for whites of their eyes. And I was like, I need to make out who this is. They're going to hurt me. Yeah. And then they touched my roommate, but they never left the house. It was very bizarre. And I always thought it was an angry shadow person out to hurt me. And when you think about it, it's like, what indicated that was harmful to us?
Sure.
Because it was uncomfortable. I think it was just the way of getting our attention. And why not when we sleep? If it has more power when we sleep than when we're awake, if we're more vulnerable when we're sleeping, it doesn't necessarily mean something bad. And so I thought about it. I did a lot of research and I thought, oh, he was just saying hi. Like it just froze me. But he didn't do anything. He didn't like stand over me and go, oh, you know, like get in my face. Sure. So, you know, I never want to discount anyone's experiences. I don't want to discount anyone's fear. It's valid. It's uncomfortable if you've never seen it before, especially if you've never, you know, you don't know what the intentions are. I thought in that moment I could get stabbed and I wouldn't be able to move. So when it comes to sleep paralysis, I think it is a way of getting our attention, but we need to remove the same with scratching, same with loud bangs, noises, things getting thrown. It doesn't always mean evil. So I think that, you know, what you're experiencing obviously could have been very frightening, but it sounds like something that probably just was like, this is the best way I can do it. And they can't control how they manifest.
Now, you just said you have been recovering from a terrible flu and you had probably the most intense paranormal investigation. Can we please deep dive into this?
So my girl, Bree, I've been connected to her for a very long time. She is a superstar in Pittsburgh. She owns a floral shop. She owns a few businesses and she's in Pittsburgh's top 40 under 40. She is a mom and a role model, calls me about 2 years ago and says, I have a historic property you might like. And I'm like, okay, I'll get to it. And she doesn't say what's at the property. She just says, you might like it. So I have another friend in town that says, I have an old general store. And I'm like, same town. Perfect. Let's come and film a documentary and bring my friends. I thought nothing was going to happen. I braced everyone for that. I said, you know, most of the time we do this, we go in, we don't find anything, or we're able to reduce it to electrical wiring, all of these things. Sure. And by the third day, I sat Bree down and I said, ma'am, I have a few questions, because why didn't you tell me your house was insane? And she said, I wanted you to have an authentic experience. And I said, well, I certainly did. And a lot of times, you know, we want our equipment to go off, but there are investigators in the field, and I'm not knocking anyone, but that's their goal, is to make the equipment go off, flash on a screen. And what was happening here is we had some of that, but there was other things that were going on. For example, Bree walks in the house. She owns it. She's owned it for 4 years, reaches above the top of a door in the molding and finds a 100-year-old skeleton key for the first time. There's never been touched. Like right as we start filming. Wow. And I'm like, this is weird. And then, you know, my camera guy comes down and I said, Chris, what's that on your neck? And I was like, you got scratched. And he goes, I don't believe in that. He's got a 3-inch scratch on his neck. I'm like, you would have had to literally drag that down. And he says, I don't believe in it. And I was like, fine, we won't put it in the documentary. You don't believe you got scratched. I'm not taking your experience from you. And then the water started running black from the pipes and Bree goes, the house is attacking. I'm like, what is going on? Because I don't believe in the demonic narrative, but something there was like, speak to me. And when you go upstairs, there is, you know, electrical connections that will make your hair stand on end. So we do have free flowing EMF on top of everything else, but something wasn't adding up. And so the neighbors next door historically were the traders. This is the site of the first and last meetings of the Whiskey Rebellion, where a bunch of Pennsylvania farmers got mad about the excise tax added to their whiskey. So they decided to tar and feather the tax collector. Think of the energy that you have associated with that. So, yeah, like that's a pretty violent way to go. So these meetings are being held at this place. And you have the neighbor who was telling on people to the tax collector. So this neighbor owns this house, and even today they said, "You can't film here. We don't ju let just anyone in." And I was like, "It's like history repeating itself." And then my film crew filmed the next door house twice, the wrong house. And then Bree said, "Oh, that's the house that's historically competed." And every time this house got an upgrade, they got jealous. So we have a film crew there, and that house is drawing them over. I screamed at the producers, and I said, "There is a concurrent, parallel, paranormal experience happening to all of us, and it's affecting us." And I was like, "You don't know this, Chris, but you accidentally called Amanda, my dead friend's name, Fran." And I was like, "Nothing is making sense. Everyone is confused, and I don't know what's going on." And I said, "I want to go back to the tavern," because we did a few locations in this whole ghost town. But I was like, "The tavern is speaking to me." So they said, "Why would we go back somewhere where we've already been?" And I was like, "Listen to me." So after sparring it on camera with them, they finally decided to go back. And I said, "I want to embody the spirit of the Whiskey Rebellion in this basement. I want to become these people." So I take Amanda Paulson, who's like the best investigator that I know in this country, and Viva, who is a historian and tour guide and investigator from Ohio. We have like a super team of investigators. And I said, "We're all on edge. We're angry. We become these farmers." So we go to the basement. Amanda, somehow crafts a way to make a proximity pod. So a proximity pod will detect if something touches the object and it goes off. She turns a whiskey bottle into a proximity pod. So we are like innovating here. We go to the basement. I have something called a tripwire that detects EMF. And we go, "If they take this whiskey from us, what else are they going to take? They're just letting," and we really just try to be these people for a minute to draw out this energy. And my friend is channeling, and she says, "Don't open it." And we're like, "We need to open this door," because there was a medium there, and he said, "Don't open that door in the basement." We're investigators. We have to figure out what's going on. So even though we're not supposed to open this door because a human told us, spirit didn't tell us that, a human did, we're going to open it. So we've ripped this coal cellar door open, and everything just changes. One of the tripwire lights just solid green. So that means something has entered that EMF and is just standing there. There is a hovering energy. And I said, "I feel like something's standing there." Someone runs out crying. And I was like, "All right, we have to keep going. I want to have empathy." But, she was frightened. So I hand my other friend the headphones and spirit box to do something called Estus. So she's channeling. She has no idea what's going on now that we've opened the door. And I said, "Okay, so you scared my friend. I don't know why that happened. But if you're here, could you give us a sound?" And as soon as I say it, this never happens. On command, you hear bang, all the lights on the tripwire light up. And the person who's under, blindfolded, can't hear anything, says, "I feel like someone just entered the room. They just walked in the door." And I was like, "Okay, like this is paranormal. This is what I live for." So we had validation outside of the equipment, because sometimes the equipment can have false evidence. And we really tapped into something. And unfortunately, filming was wrapping up at this point. So I have to go back to this property, but I was like, "We need to close this door," because for some reason, when we opened the door, some things stirred up. We put a sigil on the door and we close it. And my friend and I decided to take a walk to the river downtown later. Everyone else fled. They were too afraid to go back in the basement. And again, that's not knocking them, that my friend and I went back down, but only the two of us would. So we're walking alone. It's just us. And we're walking to this, it's a ghost town. Every other building is abandoned. Maybe every two, like one building and then two abandoned ones. Like it is dismal. We are heading down to the bridge to throw some things in the river. And this guy jumps out in front of us. And in that moment, it felt like he wasn't there. I thought we were going to get jumped the same way I felt with the shadow figure. And I was like, "Oh no." And I said, "Excuse me, sorry." And he didn't even crack a smile, didn't say, "I apologize." So we get off of the sidewalk to walk around him because I thought he would hurt us. Passes Amanda and I, and he said, did you shut the door? And we looked at each other and we were like, excuse me, sir. He said, did you shut that door? And we could not believe it. On top of that, you know, that blew our minds. Like sometimes the synchronicities, you know, you can't capture that in a REM pod. You can't capture that in a piece of equipment. That was like true paranormal. And we threw the things we needed to in the river and we headed back to the house. But there were other things, like the main issues at the house, it sits on sandstone. So it's recorded all of this memory. It's got like the stone underneath it. The whole town is built on sandstone. It's, it used to be an indigenous mound. There's the, you know, it was stolen land, unfortunately. And there's all this stuff going on. And it's almost like the historical oppression is repeated in this town. But a lot of the activity at the house was electrical. And a lot of people say, oh, bad wiring. But that doesn't explain, you know, we have the pulsating electric there. But we go back to our Airbnb after investigating and the kitchen light goes out and the refrigerator goes out. And we called the Airbnb owner and she comes over and she said, did you bring something back from the tavern? And we were like, why would you say that? And then we went to go eat dinner in the city an hour away, just Amanda and I. Power goes out on the whole block. And we're like, what is following us? And, you know, my story didn't end there. And I haven't talked about this to anyone really other than Amanda. I had this gut feeling that I didn't need to drive the 5 hours home to Richmond. I wanted to go to Indiana to return some things. And something was just telling me, return those things. So I head back to Indiana and Indiana, Pennsylvania. So I pull up to the house where I normally park, literally in the spot where I park. And as soon as I do it, my transmission blew. And if I had not listened to my gut, I would be on a highway going 70 miles an hour and my car would have stopped. So don't outsource your intuition. Listen to your gut. It really was intense. It was synchronicities, like literally like just a storm, like constant fired synchronicities, actual tangible evidence with the equipment. It was the most exciting investigation I've ever been on. And, you know, I don't think the documentary is going to capture the truth of what we experienced. So we're going to have to talk about it on podcasts and we're going to have to talk about it in lectures, but I hopefully can get it on paper. I wrote everything down. Everyone I've called, they're like, did they plant the person that said, did you shut the door? I said, no, this is real. This is the craziest thing I've ever experienced. So, you know, I was tired for a few days and then I immediately got the flu, which makes sense. Like I was swollen. My energy was just gone and investigations don't go like that. And I do this all the time.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like there's been a detachment? Have you done anything like spiritual to like cleanse yourself, detach, Reiki, sage, any of those like common beliefs around that? Or for you, just letting your body go through the process?
Normally, I would, you know, I had different protections that I did. And I made the mistake of outsourcing my protection for a while. And I realized, you know what? I made myself this little protection bag of crystals and herbs. And for some reason, I lost faith in my ability to protect myself. I don't think anything attached to me, but I do think it was just emotionally and energetically draining in general. Sure. And so I put my protection back in my pocket and I said, to be gone with any other outsourced protection, any other fabricated protection from people that I don't know have my best interest in mind. And I took days to just sleep. I think I've been sleeping for about 5 days and just kind of getting back to balance. I'll probably take an Epsom salt soak and just kind of reflect on it. Be in nature, I think, is another good way to ground yourself and, you know, meditate on it, writing it down, getting it off my chest, telling the story is all cathartic. It just takes a while to balance yourself, you know, and with social media, there's this demand of more, 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 which you can do if you're going in closed off. But if you're wide open, acting like a beacon for this kind of stuff, it's like, you're going to be tired. I'm old. Like there are things that, you know, you just have to recover from, and eating better, eating well, because the day after all the activity, we stopped at this, it's called Sheetz and it's like a super gas station.
Oh, I know Sheetz, girl. I traveled the US.
Yeah, so Sheetz is amazing. So, you know, and I'm sitting down and I buy something I'd never buy. I'm pretty careful about what I eat, but I saw this rainbow cake that literally looked like a cartoon. And I sat down and my friend had, you know, gone off in the store and she didn't see me. And I saw her buying donuts in the corner. And I was like, we are so drained that we're like carbs, sugar. And she sat down and I was like, I can't even, it was literally like 1,000 calories for a slice of cake. And I ate it. And I was like, I just need to come back to life. And now I feel pretty animated, obviously still recovering from like the actual flu part, but
sure.
Yeah, it was intense.
I always find it funny because I like to draw everything or correlate everything back to sport, because I think everything is kind of deep rooted in the mindset of, you know, sport is just like the modern version of going to war. And most of us were just made to be fighters. And do you, so that's your post, your recovery from these investigations. What do you do pre-investigation to prep your body, mind, and spirit?
You know, you have to get a full night's sleep or you're not going to be able to really perceive things. Your perception is going to be off, especially if you, a lot of people will try to drive overnight, get to the place. It's like, you're going to hallucinate a little bit if you're sleep deprived.
Sure.
Good night's sleep, full meals, eating on time, which is a mistake that we made, trying to get everyone on the same page. So that was where, you know, we had this rope made and blessed where everyone kind of put the rope in circles and circles and pulled it together in a ritual to try and get everyone on the same page. That is so important. If you have investigators that aren't on the same page, one person's a demonologist and another person doesn't believe in that, and you have a skeptic, people are not going to get along and it's going to be hard to perceive that. So that was something we did, an exercise to do research, but not too much research, because one thing we learned, we can't research every single thing that happened here in Brownsville. And, you know, being blind on the research actually helped a little bit, because I found out that there was a guy in the Whiskey Rebellion. His name was Brackenridge. And the first night he went to the tavern, he was afraid that the farmers were going to kill him. So he goes and everyone's not getting along and they're not, you know, getting on the same page, similar to what was happening to the investigators the first night. So he leaves the tavern knowing I didn't finish what I accomplished, what I wanted to accomplish. So he goes around town getting other stories. We go around town visiting other paranormal locations or locations with alleged hauntings and investigating and getting other stories around town. But I fought to go back to the tavern and I didn't know why. And I found out this guy Brackenridge, literally, you know, over 200 years ago, also was fighting to go back to the tavern, but didn't know why, because he knew that the only way he could do what he intended to do was return to the tavern. And I found this out after. And I'm like, I'm glad I didn't know that before, because I subconsciously picked up the psychic imprint of Brackenridge. And now here we are. We have this amazing experience where I must have picked up on that. And so then I started researching Brackenridge more. And I find this article that says Brackenridge was entering these meetings with Albert Gallatin. Now, my last name is Gallantine, but I'm from Pennsylvania originally, actually. And Gallantine used to have two L's. And before it used to have two L's, it was Gallatin. And it's not a very common name. We are from, you know, the German-occupied region of Switzerland. So I found out that my ancestor was at these meetings of this place that we're investigating. And I was like, that makes sense. That makes sense why I picked up on that imprint. That makes sense why I wanted to reenact the Whiskey Rebellion and focus on that area of the investigation. So, you know, again, this is the most intriguing investigation I've ever experienced. Something that, like, it shows that the paranormal is not going to manifest the way you expect it. It's not a bunch of gadgets going off. It's not a bunch of, you know, people sitting on chairs at home telling the same story over and over. It's out there. It can happen. It can happen unexpectedly. It can happen in front of a camera. And it sometimes, you know, there's two different stories being told. And I know the documentary that everyone is going to watch has nothing to do with the crazy stuff that I just told you.
What I think is really interesting and the most significant paranormal experience I've ever had is the amount of layers. And I just want to circle back to one that's probably overlooked, and it's probably because you have no idea what it's like until you experience it. And that was the mass confusion and volatility that was created between your crew. Because when I've had that experience that I talked about with the rolling pin sensation and the sleep paralysis, and I've spoken on this before, my partner in the podcast, her and I had a really irrational, angry conversation that neither of us could really explain in the moment. It felt really off and it felt really emotionally charged. And when we circled back on it like a year later, she was like, you know, I remember that conversation, but it was like the content of the information didn't match the emotions and there was something else at play. In your experience or your belief around that, what do you think that is? Like what is causing this irrational human experience? Do you just think it's another way of the paranormal trying to communicate with us?
This is so interesting. I just had this conversation last night with a friend and I talked about what I refer to as isolation, where someone on the investigation or at the haunted location or where the experience is occurring doesn't feel like they're on the same page as everyone else. And I've seen it so many times. And I'm like, we're all passionate. Why can we not agree? Be kind. Why is someone crying? Someone always cries. Yeah. And I don't have an issue because I've been the crier. I've been that person. And it felt like no matter what I say, I can't get on the same page with the people in the room. And we all like each other. Nobody hates each other. Nobody's on bad terms. So why is this going this way? And that's where, I'm not a psychologist, and I've been talking to a psychologist about this experience specifically for this reason. And I said, what could cause this? What causes this? Yeah. And I could say maybe one person was insecure one time, but when I know seven people that it's happened to where they say there was this one investigation where I couldn't get on the same page as everyone else, and I felt like they were in it for the wrong reasons or they weren't paying attention to spirit. So then that person starts crying or feels picked on, and when you say the irrational anger, and I know a lot of people who don't acknowledge or don't buy into the demon narrative, but will also acknowledge a time where they felt that spirits made them angry or they picked up on the angry imprint. And you have to think about the Whiskey Rebellion. Your government, which you just are establishing, you know, America's very new, and there's this excise tax on whiskey, and you feel betrayed by your government. Your poor farmers in rural Pennsylvania that live within your means, and they're going to take more from you. And so you're meeting in these places, and you're saying exactly what we think they would have been saying. I don't want to share my opinion. What if they know what I'm thinking? It's almost like we picked up on that. And there are some things that I feel like would have happened either way. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but I will say this investigation was slightly friendship ending. And and it needed to happen, but it was like, it had this way of exposing everything wide open, everyone's insecurities, everyone's upset, honesty, or dishonesty all came to light. But there has to be more to it. And I agree with what you're saying about, like, you guys felt that anger. There is some reason that people feel a discord. That's what I kept saying. I did my exit interview and I was the last one and everyone was gone. And I was so upset. I said, I brought the best researchers that I thought at a professional tarot reader, professional medium that I've worked with for years, the best investigator from the West Coast that I could think of, a historian. I paid over $1,000 for everyone to have lodging. And I felt like I got everyone on the same page. I had a good solid friend of 14 years from my past there. And I say everyone was here for a reason, even if they felt like there wasn't a reason or they were being undermined. I felt that everyone had a reason to be here. And when it started going wrong, I felt very frustrated. And I end my interview. They asked me, anything else you'd like to say? I said, I regret bringing everyone here. But there's no way I could have known that the common denominator is me, and I'm friends with all these people, and I love all these people. How could it possibly go horribly awry? Sure. And, a lot of it stemmed from they don't they don't believe what we're experiencing, or this person doesn't believe us. And I called afterwards and I made some amends. And I said, you know, you weren't in danger. I wouldn't have, if I felt that opening that closet would have put you in danger. Is it valid that it scared you? Of course. But that doesn't mean you're in danger. You're not going to get possessed. And so it's just, there really has to be a cohesive nature and same page to the people who are investigating.
Very interesting. It's just so funny because, like I said, no one can really explain that sensation until you've experienced it. And that's probably why we're all kind of chasing our tails, because it's, you know, it's a very hard thing to explain. But I'm sorry for the loss of your friendship in it. But these experiences just seem to, I don't want to say they upgrade you, but they naturally just separate people, because how can they not? You're forever changed.
Yep. Yeah. And that's it. I didn't leave angry. I mourned. And then I said, this needed to happen. Yeah. I needed to take back my own power. I needed to step into my own power. And, you know, I needed to see what people's intentions were. And I left with, you know, some of the best friends of my life as well. Amanda and I, you know, experiencing that with the, did you shut the door thing? It becomes like, we're going to be friends forever. Like, we saw that together. We were in our own little world for a few days. I'm sure. Like, I feel like I, of all places, I want to drive an hour away to take you to this Vietnamese restaurant. And this, you know, there's nobody else in the restaurant. And I was like, this place is usually packed. And so we sit down and we order our spring rolls and we're eating. She's like, wow, this is really good. I'm like, it's my favorite place. And then the power goes out and she's like, record, record. And it was just constant, like rapid fire, like event, 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 not a dull minute. And it's finally settled down. But, you know, I didn't get the questions I wanted answered, which are, who's haunting that place? Yeah. Obviously, I think it has something to do with the rebellion. And, you know, the people at the rebellion were in such discord that they didn't want to tell what their position was. Mm-hmm. So they would write how they felt on a piece of paper. And to hide it, they ate the paper. So,
wow. Bizarro. Yes. So let's just take a step outside of the paranormal for a moment. I always believe professional wrestling is a sport that collects misfits, because you don't really fit in anywhere in the world, but yet you fit in this professional wrestling world and people are very bonded quickly. Did you grow up watching wrestling at all?
I did watch some wrestling, like Ric Flair
era. Oh, perfect.
And so I've photographed. I used to photograph for an event venue, so I took pictures of Sasha at some point, the girl with the purple hair.
Yes, Sasha Banks.
Yes, and so I have some really nice pictures I took of her maybe 10 years ago now.
Oh,
but,
wow.
So I'm familiar in that capacity, but I'm not familiar with the world, as some of my friends are. But I think every niche kind of has similar like group dynamics, and people get drawn for whatever reason, whatever passion brings them in that direction.
Love it. I'd love to wrap this up with kind of a rapid fire questionnaire. I call it my top 10 tailor-made questions. Are you ready to do a little bit of a speed round?
Sure.
Okay, great. What is your favorite paranormal movie?
Conjuring.
The Conjuring.
The first time it came out, I watched it like 4 times in a row. I've been to the actual collection, the Warren's collection in the United States.
Yes.
So I've definitely deviated from their style of investigations and that history. But when it came out, I was like, whoa, like no like CGI, like phantoms or boogeymen. It's like, what a haunting, how can a haunting affect you? And right. I've been to the Conjuring house and I lived in Connecticut for a few years. So it really, really intrigued me.
Love that. Now, what would be your favorite paranormal book or the last paranormal book you read?
I read a lot of like historical books on the paranormal. There is a book on The Conjuring called House of Darkness, House of Light. A lot of paranormal literature is bad. I would recommend Goodbye Hello by Adam Berry and My Life with the Afterlife by Amy Bruni, which are two very good friends of mine, because they bring a human approach to the paranormal. And Adam has also blended grief in the paranormal. And it's been it's like a balm for your soul in the way that it is. But a lot of, you know, literature that exists pre-current era is filled with misinformation, racism, and misconceptions about the occult.
Okay. What is your favorite beauty product?
You know, I'm obsessed with Profusion's Casper makeup collection that they just put out. They have like a it's probably horrible for my face, but they have a primer that has glitter in it, and then the setting spray has glitter, and I love glitter, so I was like, I love this. And you know, it was sold at CVS, not any of the big stores, and Walgreens. And so when I got it, people were like, what is that highlight? And I was like, it's the Casper stuff. So I've been loving that lately.
So you love glitter.
Yes.
What is the biggest misconception about paranormal investigations?
That we always have activity and that we're looking to get scared. There are so many times I sit alone in the dark and nothing happens. And I am just basically feeling like I'm talking to myself. And I would say that happens almost for 6 months to a year at a time before something like this weekend happens. That won't happen again for 10 years. You know, it's really special when it truly makes you go, okay, this is why I do what I do. But most of the time, we're just quiet. It's nothing to note or easily debunkable.
Okay. What is a fun fact about you that we wouldn't be able to pinpoint via what you put out there in the social media world?
I probably can name every single 1980s Generation One My Little Pony by just looking at them. I'm a huge My Little Pony enthusiast. I always will be. A lot of people think that that part of me has like subsided or like that I'm ashamed of it. And I was like, no, I think My Little Pony's cool. I think it's cool to like what you like. And I'm not into like the G3 like brony stuff. But I grew up with My Little Pony and I think they're cute and they smell good and you know, they're artful. It really required a designer for each one and they really had to outdo themselves. So it's kind of like when you really get into that world, it's like, wow, like they had to design the symbols. That was an art piece in its own and then lines. So I always just loved it.
Okay, now I think I know the answer to this, but you never know. Fast fashion or thrifting?
Thrifting. I started thrifting in high school, and I actually was thinking about this the other day too. Like I was forced to dress differently, so I had to build a style out of that because my mom wasn't like an Abercrombie. Everyone was wearing Abercrombie and Hollister and all of these brands, and I felt like, you know, how do I look a way that makes sense, that feels authentic to me without buying the stuff that everyone else is buying. And I remember the first vintage piece of clothing that I brought. And now I stay away from it. And I get offered a lot of free clothes because I have followers on social media. And I'm like, I can't sacrifice my ethics. I can't fill the landfill with more plastic clothes.
Now, if you did have a choice, what is your, oh, of course you have a choice, but when you're not thrifting, what is your favorite brand?
There's a brand called Blackwood Castle in Canada, and
Okay.
it's, you know, queer woman-owned, sustainable fashion, and it's all Victorian inspired. And I wear her dresses a lot, and the threads don't pull off, and they're incredible. They actually are structured, which you don't see. Like a lot of stuff you see, you go, oh, it's pretty. You put it on, and then, you know, the boning starts to change, or like the dress starts to stretch out in a weird way. So I love that brand. There's a lot of really awesome woman-owned spooky brands, Foxblood, Lively Ghost, that are all, you know, sustainable.
Okay. What is your favorite band or artist?
I would say my favorite band, it's always been the Smashing Pumpkins. It was my favorite band growing up, and I've seen them quite a few amount of times. So I would say that, and My Bloody Valentine, obviously, is a favorite band of
Obviously.
mine.
It's funny, Billy Corgan is a massive wrestling fan, and
I'm
he
huge. That's true.
actually,
Yes.
isn't that crazy? And
Yeah.
he, I
He.
believe, is the head of creative or the VP of a professional wrestling TV show called NWA that's active right now. So there's our correlation right
Yeah, absolutely.
there. Who has been your most embarrassing crush?
I told my boyfriend recently that I had a crush on the clown from Luna and Molly and the Big Comfy Couch growing up. And he was like, the clown? And I was like, yeah, there was the clown with the big hair, and he was so cute with the bicycle.
I remember.
Okay, so you're telling me that your type is clown. And I was like, I don't know.
No judgment. I think that's great.
The
Okay, last one. Finish this lyric. The world is a vampire.
Santa Dre.
Yes, girl. Woo! Push you outside your comfort zone.
Betrayed the science.
Yes, there it is. We are getting to the point in the Wild On podcast world where we need to expand our niche. This is always going to be the home of professional wrestlers because these are my sisters and my brothers. But I really want to explore other worlds of amazing men and women who do things literally out of this world. I hope it shed a little bit of light on what your understanding of paranormal investigations, death, grief, and anything in between. This experience forever changed her life, and you got to hear it first on the Wild On podcast. Please don't forget to subscribe to this channel to miss, you don't want to miss any of the weird, wacky, wild content we bring you weekly on Wednesdays. And until next week, stay calm and wild on. Blessed be.